Prepare to broadcast worldwide.
You've discovered TalkZone.com.
TalkZone.com.
Now, TalkZone presents The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why, Insights and Solutions to Some of America's Most Troubling Societal Problems, featuring community activist Robert L. Woodson Sr., who has spent decades promoting solutions to some of the most challenging problems facing our nation today. Now, here's your host, Bob Woodson.
Welcome, everyone. This is The Bob Woodson Show. We're pleased that you're joining us today for The Bob Woodson Show, What Works and Why. We're going to look beyond the headlines again to see if there are solutions behind the bad news. Today's topics, the overlooked resource in domestic and national security. Last week, we talked about the reduction in homicides nationwide and the role of an engaged citizenry in reducing crime and violence. Extending this principle to the national security, how can we engage citizens further to work to protect this country and produce civil order in other countries? What are the resources that exist in communities across this country, and why are they overlooked, and what can be done to better utilize them? And as we do in this show, we look for solutions. Our guest to explore these issues is William Shambra, Stuart Butler, and Bernard Gant. Dr. William Shambra is director of Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philosophy and Civil Renewal. He's also served as a director of program at the Bradley Foundation in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and senior advisor and chief speechwriter for former Attorney General Edward Meese III. And Bill was also the director of Office of Personnel Management, Constance Horner, and the secretary of Health and Human Services, Louis Sullivan. Dr. Stuart Butler has guided the Heritage Foundation domestic policy research for more than 30 years as Vice President of Domestic and Economic Policy Studies. What is little known is that before that, as a young researcher, Stuart went around the country looking at grassroots leaders to find out directly from them what is the source of their success. And I think some of that early experience had influenced his work and hopefully his perspective on the world today. Dr. Bernard Gant is the founder, one of the associations of Christian Schools International. Bernard, would you start by just telling us something about yourself and your organization and just what you do?
Thank you, Bob. I am the director of Urban School Services with the Association of Christian Schools International, ACSI. ACSI is the largest association of Protestant Christian schools in the world, serving nearly 5,000 member schools worldwide. In my responsibilities as the director of Urban School Services, I'm responsible for the schools in the U.S. that target and serve under-resourced, academically at-risk, and minority student populations.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. You know, I was struck by the fact that we normally, everyone is talking about this Christmas bomber, this young man who, you know, got on a plane and came on Christmas Day and tried to ignite some explosives sewn in his underwear. And people normally think of terrorists as being from underprivileged backgrounds who are angry at the world and at everything, and therefore that's why they're motivated to and they're easily recruited. But a different profile emerges around this young man whose name I will not try to pronounce, and I challenge anyone else to. But it says here, and he grew up in luxury in a walled courtyard of his family home in Nairobi. And when he went to college, he lived not in a dorm, but in an apartment that his parents maintained in a posh London neighborhood. But as the 16th of the youngest child of his father's two wives, he may have been gotten, he may not have gotten much parental attention. He was sent off to a British-style boarding school for children and diplomats and a rich West African businessman. It says, but the young man's comments are very telling, which gets us to the subject of this show. He says, and I quote, "I had no one to speak to, or no one to consult, no one to support me. I feel depressed, lonely, isolated. I do not know what to do, and I think loneliness leads me to other problems." And even he was shunned by other kids at the school. Another article in Commentary magazine talks about destroying this myth that somehow these terrorists are from an underprivileged background. And in fact, there was several studies that report that a large segment document 102 Islamic radicals involved in global jihad. Roughly three quarters of these men could be classified as upper class or middle class from the information that they've been able to glean. He concluded that members of the global jihad are generally middle class educated young people. He said desperately poor individuals were not. And other studies have come to similar conclusions. In 2005, for instance, another study by the PAS examined the biographies of 154 Arab jihadists who died in Iraq, and 70% were from upper income families. So that my point here is that a lot of us believe that the violence that we're witnessing and the people who are available as predators in the inner city tend to be low-income minority young people. And our approach to stopping that violence is through police repression, longer sentences, when in fact we have been applying these for years without success. Another approach is to perhaps bribe them through social programs or therapeutic intervention, and that has failed. But we know from our experience at the Center for Neighborhood Enterprise and our efforts that has been the theme of this show over the few weeks, that young people can't be coerced into changing or threatened, but they must be inspired to by people who share their same cultural zip code and sometimes geographic zip code. But this resource seems to be ignored or overlooked as a tool to protect us. And you look at Tiger Woods and Martin Sheen, Robert Downey Jr., all wealthy, powerful, well-connected individuals who are living so-called a life of luxury, and we're told that secular success and money and power are supposed to provide you with the sense of importance that exempts you from engaging in self-destructive behavior. And so, as we have been exploring on this show and in our work over the past 30 years, the remedies or the solutions are to go to those civic institutions that are indigenous to the community suffering the problem and inspire these young people to fill that sense of emptiness in them by providing them with people who walk with them every day, all day, and provide them hand-holding with the kind of guidance that then recruits them to life-affirming activities as opposed to being recruited by the forces of evil. In the case of the inner city, either a predatory gang will recruit these kids and fill that empty hole in their soul in their body, or it will be filled by someone who is affirming life. The same affluent young person, whether they are foreign or domestic, who is growing up in affluence but feels a sense of emptiness, that hole is going to be filled by something or someone, and sometime it's being filled by terrorists. In fact, a recent study I saw that the Aryan Nation gang is recruiting among upper-income white kids in Orange County, California. And so it is now something that we must address. And so for my three guests, I'd like to ask you, would you comment on why this resource, first of all, do you think it's a valid resource? Am I off track somewhere? You know, assessing it? Am I placing too much value or importance on this as a resource for this nation?
Well, Bob,
go ahead.
This is Bill Shambra. I would say that a real problem that we face as a society is we tend to think of professional service providers as a substitute for that, for the kinds of groups that you're talking about. And we really have underplayed the kind of indigenous groups you're referring to and their strengths, which are often strengths rooted in religious faith. And we tend to look at professionally trained providers as a substitute. The indigenous groups end up being sort of pushed aside by the professional service providers. Ironically, as I listened to your description of the Christmas Day bomber, he was being trained to be a part of that professional class. I mean, that was one of the objectives that I'm sure his parents were hoping for him, and he had probably an aspiration he had for himself was to be a part of that professional class. And yet he found an emptiness there. He wasn't able to find the kind of affiliation that would provide some sense of fulfillment. And as you say, he turned to a very negative expression of religious faith to fill that hole. But the groups that you've been working with for 30 years and that I've, you know, been watching sort of over your shoulder as a friend and supporter of the center, you know, these groups have found a way to fill that emptiness in a healthy way, and they've provided a kind of effective service that the professional service providers simply cannot provide. I mean, it's interesting. We look at, for instance, Katrina, the Hurricane Katrina, in response to Katrina, and we know that all of these grand bureaucracies that we've constructed to respond to crises and to disasters failed us, with the exception of the Coast Guard. Coast Guard did pretty well. But all of these disaster services were miserable failures. What really worked well, and this has been found in a number of studies, were the small faith-based voluntary groups that were much more flexible, responsive, much more adaptive to the kinds of conditions they found on the ground. And they did terrific work. They were uniformly much more successful than these professional service providers we've been talking about.
And Bernard, what is your response to that?
Bob, I agree wholeheartedly. In the many years that I have dedicated myself to addressing the educational plight of urban youth and trying to curtail this crisis that is growing by each generation, I have come, and I will refer your listeners to an article that appeared in the Review of Educational Research back in the spring of last year on interpersonal relationships. And the authors of this article, I think, have just hit the nail on the head. They say that we seek to demonstrate that the greater the connectedness on personal and emotional levels, also referred to as relatedness and relational processes, in the academic context, the greater the scope for academic motivation, engagement, and achievement. In other words, we're discovering that the key ingredient, which has been a missing ingredient in the development of these young people, particularly this at-risk population that is so susceptible to the virulent ills that you have been outlining, is relationships. And you're absolutely right. Where there are few positive relationships resulting in positive options, the greater chance that negative options will prevail. They're going to present themselves either way. The question is, do they have the opportunity to take root? And we're finding out that, and this is the reason that I've engaged in this whole matter of values-based education. Not that we're teaching precepts or that we're just speaking to the intellect, because we already know that being smart does not necessarily preclude being a person of character and having values. We've got enough political evidence to indicate otherwise. But that the key is who's influencing or who's bringing to bear the near examples to these young people and inspiring them. And that is the stuff of relationships. And as educators like Ruby Payne and others are demonstrating, that if we're going to have a positive impact on the lives of these young people, we have not only have to instruct them in what they should know in their heads, but we have to inspire them with what they should believe in their hearts. And that comes from near relationship, or as these authors have pointed out, relatedness.
Stuart?
Yes, I think you were. It was absolutely correct at the very beginning, Bob, to point out that what we saw in the recent attempted bombing, and indeed many of the terrorists and revolutionaries from many, many years ago, in as well as today, come from typically middle or upper income families. Osama bin Laden comes from a very affluent Saudi family. And I think that, as you said, it's critical to understand that at a certain stage in life, almost everybody goes through some process of alienation or confusion. Often people who have money, who are given money by their parents, go through this to say, do I deserve this? Should I be thinking differently? This is what we see throughout history. And the important thing is what happens then. And so often what we find is that we see this in poor communities as well as affluent communities, of course. What we often find is that as people grope around looking for some way to connect, if the family is not there, as in so often the case in, of course, single-headed households, or if there isn't any other community that engages this person, then they try to find something else. And often that's an ideological connection in the case of better educated and upper income people. They look for ideologies in ways that often look people from poor neighborhoods are not interested in the ideologies, getting basic things done. But one of the things that comes with affluence is this yearning for ideological sort of understanding and symmetry and so on. And that's, I think, what we see. And the solution to all of these things, whether it be in poor communities or these upper-income communities, as you said, is for those organizations and for those, not just families, but community organizations to re-engage these people in a much more aggressive way. And that's what we're finding in back in my former country of Britain, in the Pakistani community, for example, where there's great concern about these well-educated, middle-class Pakistanis really turning to very extreme ideologies, of trying to re-engage them with local community, people in the same zip code, people from the same family or the extended family, or, you know, a Muslim community that is much more sensible to kind of re-engage. And that's what's got to happen.
Good. We want to continue this right after our break. We're talking about the Overlook resources and our national security and how engaged citizens can work to protect our country against terrorism and domestic incivility. Our guest is Dr. William Shamber, director of Hudson Institute's Bradley Center for Philosophy and Civic Renewal, Dr. Stuart Butler, the Heritage Foundation's vice president of domestic and economic policy studies, and Dr. Bernard Gant of the Association of Christian Schools. I'm Bob Woodson, president of the Center for Enabled Enterprise, and we'll return right after these messages.